the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 145, covering the week of November 5th through November 9th, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. Also, go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. Give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, and you'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast as well as a roundup of the week. You can also download our mobile app from your App Store, Google Play, Apple Store. It is free, so go on out there and get that as your mobile interface with the Abbeville Institute, and we're very proud of it, so get that app. Also, if you do like this podcast, please rate it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast listening venue, because the more ratings, the higher ratings, the better, more people will hear it. Also, you can support the Abbeville Institute by going to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support. Click on that. You'll see donations for individuals, and you can donate monthly or annually. We are getting to the end of the year, so if you're thinking about tax ramifications for 2018, the Abbeville Institute is a nonprofit organization, and so your tax-deductible contribution is that to the full extent of the law. So consider giving us a fully tax-deductible contribution. That helps keep the podcast going, the conferences going, the website going, all those wonderful things. So if you like what we do, please consider that. Also, please consider sharing our material on social media. You can also support the Institute by going to our webpage as well. At that support button, there's a tab for shop. You click on that, you get all of your Abbeville Institute apparel. It's embroidered. It's really nice stuff. So get your t-shirts, your hats, your towels, your fleece. Winter's coming up. We do have fleece jackets with the Abbeville Institute logo on it. They are nice. So going out there and get those things. These are great ways to support the Institute. All right, well, all that said, let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. And the general theme for this week was history. And this is an interesting topic, I think, because Americans wrestle with the importance of history. And I think part of this begins with the climate that we have in America today. Some of it's the political climate, but also some of it is the way that we view education. And we're told that the STEM subjects, math and science, are more important than anything else. And this is true. These subjects are important. We need engineers. We need scientists. We need these people to go out and help build the infrastructure and help do the things that advance our knowledge of technology and health and all these other things. But at the same time, we put so much emphasis on these things, I think that one of the casualties is history, philosophy, geography. Things that are very important for your usefulness as a citizen and a participant as a citizen in a federal republic. If you go back and you look at the Renaissance period and you start discussing the changes in education, when you went from the scholastic method and transitioned to the Renaissance period, one of the things that the thinkers in the Renaissance period were very cognizant of is the importance of education and citizenship. And they thought that things like history and moral philosophy and poetry were as important as science and mathematics in developing a well-rounded individual. And so we've had this long discussion for hundreds of years about the importance of history. What is history? Why do we study it? It's a question that I often ask my students every semester. We start the semester with these particular questions and then answers and what people have said about history. And one of the quotes I often use is Jefferson's: if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and what never will be. And so you cannot be ignorant and free. And if you're ignorant of history and philosophy and literature and these softer areas, you live in a state of ignorance. But not just that, it's the way that we teach history and the way we study history that I think impacts the way that people think about things. There's no question about that. The subjects that we choose, the people we choose to talk about, the ideas we choose to discuss, the way we portray those ideas and things and events and people, all of that stuff has an impact on how people think about history and how people think about why they like or don't like history. I see it all the time when I advise students. You have students come in and say they like history or they don't like history, and generally that comes down to the way the history has been taught throughout their life, their influence from their family. How does their family teach history or talk about history? Is it negative? Is it positive? Is it taught in a way that would make them think that all of history is just bad? That, as Edward Gibbon said, history is little more than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind. Is that how history is taught? Is that all it really is? Is it just the rubbernecking news at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock when we have all the bad things discussed, all the crimes, the horrible things that go on? This is what we consume. Our pop culture is wrapped up into that. So is that really what history is? Or is it something else? Is it the beauty of a people or a society? I think that's part of it that we miss. There is one quote that we've used on the Abbeville Institute. Clyde Wilson has used it several times. But, you know, the South is a garden. This idea of a garden, of a beautiful place. Wouldn't that be a more palatable way to talk about history in the past than the register of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind? And of course, we do talk about those things. We talk about the bad as well as the good. But the good is often suppressed for a political advantage. And I think the pieces that we published this week speak to that. We focus solely on things we perceive as evil with a modern presentism. And by doing that, we turn people off from history. Why would you study, for example, John C. Calhoun, when the only thing you ever hear about the man is that he was a racist slaveholder? Well, why would you even dig any deeper to find, is there any value in this man whatsoever? Did he have anything valuable to say about American society or politics or government? And when you start doing that, you find that, of course, he was one of the most important, if not the most important, political thinker in American history in terms of original thoughts. I mean, Jefferson's very important. Hamilton's important. These people are important because of how they've impacted American society. But in terms of real original thoughts about politics and government, there is no one superior to Calhoun in American history. Not one individual. But of course, all we get is Calhoun was a racist slaveholder. And when you start doing that over and over again, you turn people off because they've heard it all before. I mean, why should I go listen to this class when all I'm going to get is the same stuff I've heard a million times? And there's nothing different about it. There's nothing beautiful about it. There's nothing worthwhile about it. There's nothing I can find that would be anything more than American history is bad. Americans are bad. The Western world is bad. Europeans are bad. Look at what they've done to all these people. And certainly, you can talk about the bad things in history, and that is an option. You can also talk about the richness of Western civilization, the richness of the tradition, the richness of the Southern tradition, which is what we do. Because not everything in the South is bad. In fact, I think you make a case that a lot of what the South contributed to American society was good. But yet, we're told that the South is just bad. And so when you do that enough times, you produce a situation where people don't really want to learn about the past. And so we started the week with a piece on Stone Mountain. And, of course, we just had our election cycle. We just had this very contentious election in Georgia. And one of the candidates in that election has been on record saying that she would essentially sandblast Stone Mountain because Stone Mountain is bad. And so this piece was important in that process, because I think what the author, Timothy Duskin, did here was attach it to something that was bigger than just the mountain itself and the monument itself. And he was talking about a man named Walker Hancock. Walker Hancock supervised the final carving of Stone Mountain. Now, this guy was not just some hayseed from Georgia, some KKK member from Georgia. And essentially, that's how it's all portrayed. If you read the pop images of Stone Mountain, it's all just about the Ku Klux Klan. Walker Hancock was one of the so-called Monument Men. He was actually portrayed by John Goodman in the film Monument Men. This guy was responsible for going out and rescuing works of art from the Nazis. He was anti-fascist. He was anti-Nazi. He was from Missouri, and he had Confederate ancestors, and he was very concerned about the portrayal of history through art. And he looked at Stone Mountain as a way to portray history through art. He was responsible for trying to save these priceless works of Western civilization from the destruction of World War II and from being seized and stolen by Nazis. And he was responsible for trying to return these things to the rightful owners. And so this guy, people don't know this. They don't know that I'm sure a lot of people have seen that movie Monument Men. They don't know that one of the guys, Walker Hancock, was responsible for Stone Mountain in its final form. And he viewed it as a very important part of his life and legacy to have participated in the carving at Stone Mountain. But yet nowadays all we get is that Stone Mountain is evil, it's racist, and it has to be removed. We've come a long way in about 80 years from when the Monument Men were running around trying to do things to save Western civilization, to save art. And then, of course, working later into the 1960s and 70s to do the same thing here. I mean, Walker Hancock had sculpted things, pro-US, pro-Confederacy, whatever it was. This was art and it was history, and he was responsible for that. In fact, as Duskin points out, he says, quote, Hancock was the sculptor of many acclaimed monuments in his lifetime, including the World War I Memorial in St. Louis, the Pennsylvania Railroad War Memorial in Philadelphia, the statue of General Douglas MacArthur at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, the statue of James Madison at the Library of Congress in Washington, the statue of John Paul Jones at Fairmount Park in Philadelphia, Christ in Majesty in the High Altar at Washington National Cathedral, the President Dwight D. Eisenhower Inaugural Medal, the bust of Andrew Mellon at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, the bust of Chief Justice Earl Warren and Warren Burger in the U.S. Supreme Court building in Washington, and the bust of Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey and Presidents Gerald R. Ford and George H.W. Bush in the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, among many, many others. This guy was an important artist. And here he is working to help finish Stone Mountain Memorial. I mean, look at the list of the people there. It's across the political spectrum. It's across American, it's a cross-reference of American society. This is a guy that was interested in just preserving important people in history. And it just so happened that Lee and Jackson and Davis were important people in American history, particularly in the South. But all you get, of course, is that this thing should be sandblasted. So why would Americans even study this any deeper if it's just attached to some evil, nefarious thing? Why would they even pay attention to history anymore? It's just all bad. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Well, yeah, that's bad. We're just going to get rid of it. If we don't learn the deeper meaning of things, if we don't learn the real story behind things, well, then it just becomes bad. Here's an artist, a man of immense talent, involved in carving this thing, who saw value in it. And yet, we just say it's bad, and so it has to go. I mean, this is how stupid this particular candidate actually was on the issue, and the people that believe the same thing in Georgia. It's just stupid. And that's really the only thing you can say for it. And following that line, we ran a piece on Wednesday by Michael Martin talking about Charleston's objective now to contextualize all the monuments in Charleston, including the Calhoun Monument, which has been vandalized, again, because he's just a racist, right? So we're going to put up plaques. And he actually quoted one of the proposed plaques that would go up at the base of the Calhoun Monument. It would have read, quote, "This monument to John C. Calhoun, erected in 1896, was a culmination of efforts begun in 1858 to commemorate his career. It was erected at a time after Reconstruction when most white South Carolinians believed in white supremacy, and the state enacted legislation establishing racial segregation. These ideas are now universally condemned. The statue remains standing today as a reminder that many South Carolinians once viewed Calhoun as worthy of memorialization, even though his political positions included his support for race-based slavery, an institution repugnant to the core ideas and values of the United States of America. This is just stupid. Calhoun's grave in Charleston is one of the most visited, I think it is the most visited grave of any vice president in America. But to put this up, as Martin says, this thing was rejected outright by locals and the subcommittee working on the project. But still, this is what people think. It was put up to honor John C. Calhoun, a man that John F. Kennedy called one of the most important Americans in American history, one of the most important senators in American history, I should say. And there's no doubt about it. This is a man that that Daniel Webster eulogized as the last of the Romans. An important person. Even when they didn't see eye to eye, he was an important person. And so this is what's happening with this, quote, contextualization and the objective of history, which, as we get into in the last couple of pieces of the week, in one way is to create social justice warriors. Because history then is used as a weapon. But it's an interpretation of history that's used as a weapon, not history itself, simply an interpretation of history. And that's problematic. We don't seek to understand, we seek to condemn. That's not what history is. History is not an effort to condemn the past, it's to understand the past. History is the remembered past, and how we remember that past is important. The good and the bad, and the ugly, but the good is something that we're often, if you say, well, you know, let's think about the good of this particular character. Oh, no, you can't do that. It just has to be the bad. Why? Why does it just have to be the bad? I do an exercise at the beginning again of the semester where I ask questions about individuals in history. And I say, tell me something good about this bad person, you know, categorically bad person. And generally, particularly if it's not an American, people try to find something in that. Well, I mean, this person did this. And then you respond with, well, tell me something bad about this good person, this deity figure in America. And they have usually I use Lincoln as the example there, they have a hard time doing it. Certain individuals are free from any type of criticism. As Duskin points out, you know, you can't, even though white supremacists, neo-Nazis and others have used Abraham Lincoln as their guy, you don't contextualize the Lincoln Memorial. You can't do that. But you can contextualize John C. Calhoun. It's just stupid. Because one group says that he did this. Lincoln had racist statements. The neo-Nazis are just pointing out things that Lincoln said. But yet we can't plaster that all over the Lincoln Memorial because supposedly he was good. He's above reproach. But yet you can put a plaque at the bottom of John C. Calhoun's monument and say this guy was evil. Because of his defense of an institution that had been part of American society since the 1600s, 200 years when Calhoun was living. We can look back on it now and say that's a terrible institution. But at the time, this was part of his society and his life. So what else did he add to society? What are the things that he contribute to society? What can we go back and look at? This is the purpose, the stated purpose of the Institute. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition? And we talk about those things all the time. So when you look at men like Calhoun or Lee or Davis or Jackson or a whole host of Southerners, even Jefferson, Washington, men who are now demonized for the positions that they held that were just acceptable at the time period. I mean, Jefferson's just a racist. Washington's just a racist. Madison, the Constitution is racist. The Declaration's racist. I mean, where do you stop with these things? It's all because of the way that history is being taught, and it's turning people off. Or they're going into history simply to find a reason to not to promote or demonize their favorite pet project or those that they're opposed to. That's why they go into history. It's not the value of it for in and of itself to understand to understand human society, human nature, what we are, what we have been. Man is what man has done. It's not to understand those things. It's to simply have a weapon to use against your political opponents. And we can go back and say, well, you know, look at the American tradition. It's been this. It's been decentralization. I mean, we can talk about that. That's not using it as a weapon. That's stating a fact. Americans have been interested in this. We can look at the long tradition of English civil liberties. And we can say, well, look, the British and the English have been more responsible for codifying those things and perpetuating those things than any other people. And that is our patrimony. And those are things that are valuable out of what we've had. That's a positive thing. But when you start saying that these people that believe those things are just all bad, well, then you take all that away. And I think people are turned off about that. They get tired of hearing these things. In fact, that's what the piece on Thursday talked about by Sam Smith. This was actually published at his blog first, at Cautious Enthusiasm. Sam Smith is a professor of history at Liberty University. And he went to a conference, and there were people there talking about history as activism, knowing the past to change the present. And he says, look, there's a lot of good things that people talk about. For example, he says, I especially appreciated how he called attention to the vastly lopsided incarceration rates of blacks to whites in Americans' prisons, and how a more careful understanding of history could give context to why this problem exists. But he says, then it went off the rails because of the way that he correlated things in history to modern political movements. And he said, he quoted Tisby, and he said this, today's activists must pursue a deep knowledge of this nation's history, especially as it relates to race and justice, in order to change the present and the future for the better. Smith goes on to say, one should note carefully what is said here. The statement makes an automatic assumption that protests and Confederate monuments, kneeling at football games and endorsing Me Too and Black Lives Matter are equally virtuous causes. The problem is that historical investigation and interpretation cannot authoritatively breach into the sphere of such value-laden assumptions. Ethicists or theologians may well connect these issues to the respective disciplines, but not so much the historian. History answers the what's and the why's. It does not readily answer the oughts. And that's true. In fact, his conclusion is wonderful. To suggest that the study of history can somehow be used as a form of social justice activism is to cloud its very purpose, namely discovering and understanding the past on its own terms. History is about knowing the past, not as we want it to be, but as it was, not for setting things right today, but for finding out why and what happened yesterday. When history is rightly written and taught, it does not need our assistance to make it relevant. If, as historian John Lukacs noted, the past is all we know, then history's importance and relevance will speak for itself, all without our Whiggish help. So when you look at what's happening with Calhoun again, we have to understand Calhoun for what he was at the time. For discovering and understanding the past on its own terms. Why did Calhoun say these things in the 1830s? Why did Calhoun say these things about government? What was leading to that? Why was he saying these things about human nature? It was his understanding of his own time that led to those things. And so we can say that we don't agree with those things today, but it's not to make it a weapon. We can say anything we want to about the past. This was good, this was bad, but it's not to make it a weapon. As Dr. Smith says, history is not a banner one can carry toward a goal, nor is it a club to bludgeon evil actors present or past. This is true. We can cite what they have done and say, you know, look, we don't agree with these things. But why did they do them? And then Smith says, this does not mean that the historian ignores evil or good in history. What Butterfield, is one of the historians he talks about, what Butterfield understood, though, was that the passion to make moral judgments was more often than not push the historian to find a shorter cut to whatever purpose he is working for. So in other words, you have preconceived notions, so you're making shortcuts. to what you're working for. It's like a science at that point. That's not what history is. It's a study of human understanding and human society and human nature. It's a study of humanity. And that's what makes history beautiful. That's what makes history beautiful. That's what makes Southern history beautiful. The things in it that are beautiful and valuable. Beautiful art, beautiful literature, beautiful music. Important political and philosophical discoveries, important scientific discoveries. This is what makes history worthwhile. And of course, everyone understands, who has a brain, that man is not perfect, that man is fallen, that man has imperfections, and he'll do things that are bad as well as good. Man is complex. Man is what man has done. So there is no perfect individual. We seek, when we say, well, this guy was evil, this guy was racist, then you by default say that we're not going to learn anything else about this person. That's wrong. That's ahistorical. It's the very definition of being ahistorical. And then you have the piece on Friday, Why Aren't Americans Interested in History, by Jonathan Harris. And he gets into this. Some historians will tell you it's because we don't focus enough on the ethnic identities or racial identities of enough people. They need history that speaks to them. But Harris says, no, that's not it. That's not it at all. What we're not doing, and Jonathan Harris is a graduate student. He has a deeper understanding of what the problem with history is, and I think than most PhDs in history. So he says that most humans do not wish to know a great deal about something they find offensive. Repulsion gives birth to avoidance. After all, if one knew their great-grandfather was a horse thief, drunk, and swindler, how much more about their grandfather would they want to know? And would they ever make one of their children his namesake? If parents are not engaged in civic duties, families are too broken down to impart identity. And Hollywood produces art that vilifies American heroes. Teaching names and dates will not suffice to cultivate an interest in a topic thought to stink in the first place. Though it be an uphill battle, perhaps the only option available to the historian is to first become the philosopher. If the values passed down through law, legend, and lore are castigated as fundamentally offensive, then the values themselves are what need explanation and defense first, not the stories that flow from them. So he's saying, look, the problem is we teach too much negative. And I think that's true. We do. We teach way too much negative. It's okay to talk about the negative, but not to pass a value on it and say these things happened. But you also had these things happening. One of the things I always try to do is show. You have all of this going on, all this rich stuff. You have all these good things. You have these bad things too, but it's all rich and it tells a story. The information will speak for itself, as Dr. Smith said. It will all speak for itself. And so Harris says, if one thing remains clear, it is this. All people use standards by which to judge those who preceded them. If the theme of American history is to be how the people of the United States did terrible things and continue to do terrible things, it would not come as a surprise that such a course would need to be mandatory in order to have any participation. The more moderate alternative, how the people of the United States failed to live up to their values but are getting better, is not much of a rallying cry either. If the standard of measure for judging the past happens to be egalitarianism, there does not seem to be any way of recovering an interest in American history as an identity marker. Its main function will be most likely be sacrificed at the altar of identity politics. So if we break these things out in race, class, gender, and this is all we do, so what you need to do is actually teach the good of all of the people of the American story, the beautiful parts of it. Isn't humanity that? When I ask a question, I ask this question too of myself, what is man? And they'll come up with all these negative terms and they ignore the beauty. Now, some will bring it up, but they ignore the beauty of humanity and what it really is as well. And I think that's part of the historian's job, to talk about the flower, the rose, not just the thorn. And I think if we can do that, if we can talk about the rose and not just the thorn, You get more people interested. Roses are beautiful and they smell great. They do have the thorn, so you got to be careful with it. But the beauty is worth it, you see. The beauty of the flower is worth it. And that said, the last piece that we'll talk about is a book review by Daniel Peters, an arch rebel like myself. It's a review of the book by that title, an arch rebel like myself, Dan Showalter and the Civil War in California and Texas. It gets into this unknown part of the American experience in the 1860s and these Confederates from California. You don't get this because, of course, it's thought that you have this very, sanitary view of the war. You have the good guys and the bad guys, and there's no complexities in it whatsoever, and these people were just this way or that way. You don't get any of this. You don't get that there were Confederates in other places. There were Confederates in California. And it's important to know that. It's important to know this very complex history of the West and American society, and that California is something more than just a bunch of, far-left progressives. I'm not going to use disparaging terms. Far-left progressives that want to radically transform society. That California at one time was different. And there were people in California that didn't necessarily agree with the direction of the United States at the time. It's complexity to history that gives us interest. This is an interesting subject and an interesting topic and one that needs exploration, but everyone focuses on the same things and whether history is good or bad or not. We miss so much because of that. I remember, again, when I was working on my dissertation, one of the things that Dr. Wilson said about my work was that I was doing something and I was writing about someone that nobody else wrote about because everybody writes about the same things. We all write about Jefferson or Washington or... take your pick of a famous figure that gets oversaturated. Lincoln. I wrote about somebody that was different, that was not in the mainstream. And so I was hoping to add to the historical knowledge of the period. And that's what we should be doing as historians, to add to the complexity and understanding of the past and take people for what they are and the time that they lived. Don't suffer from presentism. I implore people that go out and do history, whether you're a graduate student listening to this or an amateur historian, whatever you are, to study history on its merits for itself and to look for the good. To look for the good and find the good in it, because it's all there. Find the beauty in the past, and by doing that, you will get people interested in it. If all you talk about is a negative and it's these people are bad and these people do this and these people oppress this, people are turned off by that and they don't want to talk about it anymore. But if you say, this is beautiful because these people did this, or this is a beautiful thing in history, people learn it. Wow, that's amazing. That's great. And I think that is the value of history for the future generations of Americans, for our posterity. Those are the things we need to think about handing down. Until next time, good day.